All right.
So anyhow, the funding of national laboratories is complicated. If the Office of Science is responsible for one that has a significant slice of fundamental sciences in its mission, the distinction of PNL compared to other Office of Science national laboratories, Lawrence Berkeley Lab, Argonne, Oak Ridge, etc., is that the central theme here is sort of chemical and material sciences.
Mm-hmm.
The Oak Ridge central theme is material sciences. The others are much more physics in their orientation than this one. But it's always involved, has a substantial chemical engineering, a larger chemistry component, and some physics and atmospheric sciences, actually, is a component of this laboratory. And then the National User Facility, the EMSL, was really the brainchild of Bill Wiley that he pushed for. And so all the people coming in and giving advice were telling him which of these different things, all of which are in the Pimentel report, are the key technical areas, technological components of that kind of user facility. And so mass spectrometry became part of it, and EMSL held for, I think it was 8 years, the record of being having the highest field, highest resolution FTICR, even though the magnet lab, Alan Marshall's lab, has now bypassed we have a bigger one now, but it's very temporary. But for a number of years, Alan Marshall was at this meeting I mentioned, and he took home our advice to move to 15 Tesla. But Dick Smith was more conservative. We recommended 15. He settled for 12 and achieved 11.5, which I rounded up to 12 when I came here as director. That's the rule, you know, it's a mathematical rule. So 12 Tesla held the world record for a long time. And 15 Tesla was Alan's goal, and he achieved it at 14.5, which he illegally rounded to 15. And the state of the art commercially now is 15, as you probably know.
Yeah.
So at any rate, mass spectrometry, nuclear magnetic resonance, electron microscopes of all flavors, theoretical computing, these all became components of the environmental molecular sciences. Biology, but not a huge component of the laboratory. There are probably 7 or 8 people, something like that, or have biology as a discipline. But it's almost the same things that we had carved out at University of Delaware. And so in coming here initially, as, you know, a savant, dare I say that, along with Fred McLafferty and others, Alan Marshall, being part of the group that gave advice on what should be done, and many other people gave advice, and they chose some parts of that they would actually do and pursue that course. When mass spectrometry was included, Dick Smith asked me to chair the Mass Spectrometry Advisory Committee for the Environmental Molecular Sciences Laboratory. And so I came in and actually began to understand more of what they were actually doing. And we were doing well enough that I was invited to be a member of the larger advisory committee, strategic advisory committee, to this group that was developing the Environmental Molecular Sciences Lab. So anyhow, I had a successful run as department chair. We had moved up, and so we now were listed, you know, on sort of the upper part of the page in CNE News when they reported annual funding across the country, and had hired, I guess with retirements, about 15 faculty, and so had, and you know, renewed the old buildings, as well as a new building, equip them. Things are going pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
And then I returned to teaching and research.
Okay.
And I was very well funded to do teaching and research. But I had a lot of time on my hands compared to being a department chair.
Mm-hmm.
and so I wasn't unhappy. Life was good. But I was old enough that it seemed to me I should think about, beginning to kind of sort of think about retiring.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided I would not take any more graduate students. And so I would sort of play out the funding and my mm-hmm. present grants, might try for more funding and postdocs, or might not.
Mm-hmm.
And the university had a very favorable plan that if you would retire in a 3-year plan, because that's a business move to get rid of higher paid faculty,
mm-hmm.
you could take it by thirds, reduce your teaching involvement.
Mm.
They would hold your salary up until year 3 and then plunk, you're gone.
Mm-hmm.
but you can draw your retirement salary
mm-hmm.
starting at that point and so on. So that seemed kind of interesting. And I was in that frame of mind when I got the surprise phone call. Would you be interested? Would you please consider putting your name in?
Mm-hmm.
I knew National Search was being launched.
Mm-hmm.
I'd seen the job description.
Mm-hmm.
I'd actually helped write it. It was a little odd in the sense that it said the director should have an active research program.
Mm-hmm.
So he or she would know what it's like to do research in a national laboratory setting.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly going to be different from a university if you recruit someone from a university.
Yeah.
And certainly different from industry if you recruit from industry, and so on. So anyhow... I didn't chair the committee. I was a member of the committee who put together the job description, and they said, do you want to see it? No, I don't need to see the job description. Would you be interested? I don't think so. But I will talk to my wife, because it's a two-body problem.
Mm-hmm.
If she's not interested, then I'm not interested. So I'll speak to her and call you tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Well, timing is everything. Anne was not having a happy day at work.
Mm-hmm.
And so when she came home late at night, parenthetically, I should say that in the chemistry department, I taught during reasonable hours of the day. And in the art department, to get enough students in her classes, she taught at night.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was my job to pack her dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And she would teach till 11 o'clock or something like that, and come home, by which time I was pretty sleepy. And then I would go at a normal hour, and she would go in at whatever time later in the day. So our work schedules were out of sync. Our vacation schedules were totally in sync, and we toured the world, sometimes with an art theme, sometimes with a science theme.
Mm-hmm.
But by this time, I had professional colleagues all across the globe, and so life was really good. But I had promised to speak to Anne, and she'd had a bad day, and she said, yes, let's get out of here. And so I called back and said, well, guess what? You have a deal, and
mm-hmm.
so I'm willing to be considered
mm-hmm.
in this total pool of people that are going to be interviewed. Well,
this was 19.
Let's see. I've been 19... 98.
So you had a decade or so at,
yes.
Sure. at Delaware to get your work.
Sure. Thing. So I was there from 87 to 99, actually. That's part of the story, because 1988, they were actively, 1998, they were actively searching. First time, they'd been declared operational a year earlier, something like that. But they were still moving stuff in, and they hadn't really started to recruit users
mm-hmm.
very much. And so they were open for business, but not really. And they wanted this person to come in and time to report to the Secretary of Energy
mm-hmm.
in 1998.
Mm-hmm.
So at the time my name went on the list, there were 35 or so people, and I didn't take it very seriously. We came out, and you know, the small town didn't impress Ann very much. So, you know, she wasn't excited about it. Second day, they took her to Walla Walla, which is the old historic town nearby, with a liberal arts college and people that she knew who were on the art faculty. She had a wonderful time, and I knew by this time she didn't like it, so there's no point in being excited. So her second day was good, and mine was not as good. We came back. We didn't think it was serious. The list kept getting shorter and shorter and shorter. And my name was still there. So we came out a number of times. And at some point in time, her daughter is a chemistry major from the University of California, San Diego. My daughter is a history major from the University of California, Berkeley. And so I think we were down to five on the list, something like that. When we decided it was time to consult with our kids, tell them that we were considering something. Because of this crossover, and, you know, third generation artist, somehow her daughter was a chemistry major. And so the other side of her brain communicated very well with my brain. And my daughter was making a crossover in the other direction. And this was very useful. So anyhow, we call my daughter, tell her that perhaps maybe might something might come of this. And she said, "What?" "Let me talk to Mom." And so she was dead set against it. You know, she says, "Give up a tenured full professorship, distinguished career in art, to go nowhere. And be nothing. Why would you do that?" And I was listening on the extension. I said, "Wait a minute. Whose genetic daughter are you? Let's straighten this out." And so we crossed over and called the other daughter, who by this time was teaching in Tower Hill School in the East Coast. And we had actually brought her with us on one of the interview trips. She helped us pick out this house. She said, "Mom, this is your house." And I said, "No, there's no way you can afford it. I don't have a job and they won't sell it." So forget that. But she said, "It's your kind of house." Well, she was right, of course. And so we talked to the chemistry person, and she said, "Are you kidding? Haven't you seen Dad's eyes sparkle? Don't you know what he thinks about when he's spent all these years building up a department that someone else now runs, and he has one that's 10 times bigger and a staff of 200 that he can work with?"
Yeah.
"So of course you should think seriously about that." So since the advice was orthogonal, you know, it was a big victory on our part. It was okay with our immediate family that we could continue to take a look at this. So anyhow, we finally came out, because the list got down to three. One was an industry person. He actually worked for DuPont and became part of the life sciences division of DuPont. He's a very well-established industrial scientist. One was a environmental woman scientist who now is a major federal laboratory head. And let me see, I think in NASA. Not sure of that. And me. So I, you know, after that point, we had probably thought the industry guy will get it. So the woman is being kept in the game till the last moment. I'm the token old person that's kept in the game. But now we were down to three, and so it was clear something serious was going to happen. So Ann and I came out expecting to be offered the job. And so we spent a three-day visit, and we toured all the interesting sites and wineries and mm-hmm. everything they could show us. We were entertained royally, and they didn't quite get to the point of offering a position.
Mm-hmm.
So we were distraught,
mm-hmm.
disturbed, disappointed, and Anne kind of lost her temper. They were saying goodbye to us and hope you enjoyed the visit. She said, no, we wasted all these visits to this stupid city. And nothing happened.
Yeah.
So you will never see us again. And I said, thank you. Goodbye. Well, anyhow, our real estate person we had talked to, who had this house for us, was going to lose a substantial commission. And he was, you know, working the company. But they already knew how upset we were and disappointed, so to speak. And so when we were getting ready to leave for the airport the next day, the associate director of the lab, responsible for filling the position, called while I was taking a shower and wanted to talk to me. And said, no, he's busy taking a shower and we don't have a lot of time. So he said, please let me talk to him as soon as he finishes his shower. So I finished the shower and I returned his call. And he said, I want to talk to you. And I said, really, we don't have time. We have to go to the airport. So why don't you call me next week? He said, no, I'm downstairs. I'm waiting for you to come to the lobby. So my job offer was waiting to take with me to the airport. And so he said, you know, how does it look to you? And I said, I'll call you next week.
Mm-hmm.
So we were kind of huffy and in our reaction to all this. And then I told him next week a couple of things. I said, okay, clauses A, B, C, and D are fine, E and F, G mm-hmm. need to be changed, etc. Mm-hmm. And so then it looks like a good offer. And so it's the kind of offer I think I might accept. But you waited too late, so school has started.
Mm-hmm.
And so the new deal is that I can't come this year.
Mm-hmm.
We have to teach school.
Mm-hmm.
And so the earliest date that I can come would be January mm-hmm. of next year.
Mm-hmm.
But we're planning our first cruise vacation in January, which is a Delaware holiday.
Mm-hmm.
And so I cannot report until February mm-hmm. 1999
mm-hmm.
as the earliest date. And so those are the terms. You know, if you want to offer it to somebody else, I totally understand. Go to the second person on your list, or maybe I am the second. I don't know. But anyhow, that's what has to be changed. And he says, fine, no problem. Secretary of Energy is coming in 2 weeks' time. Can you join us? I said, school. Didn't you hear what I said?
Yeah.
School has started. I've given a lecture
yeah.
already. So it's not as easy as it was during the summer and so on. He said, well, we really want you here. And I said, okay, I can probably get someone to teach school for me. Of course you can. That's the way academics work.
Yeah.
Trade teaching back and forth. And so I knew I could go out there, and so I did. And I got to meet the high-ranking people from Battelle, highest-ranking people from Department of Energy, and so on. And they wanted to introduce me as a new director, and I said, no.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't worked this out. And so I agreed that they could introduce me as the person who had been selected
mm-hmm.
by the review process to become the director mm-hmm. of the Wiley Environmental and Molecular Sciences Laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the standing I had in talking to people for that very revealing visit by sort of the the show and tell that you have to do
mm-hmm.
in a national laboratory. So I went back and I made a couple of trips to Washington, D.C. to talk to the steward in the Department of Energy because I wanted to be absolutely sure that my understanding,
mm-hmm.
based on PNNL, matched up with his understanding
mm-hmm.
of what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that was okay. So I sort of asked the person who was the official steward, what are your expectations for this laboratory
mm-hmm.
and for the director? He said, pretty simple. Show me what it's good for.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
So I said, is that it? He said, oh, I can give you a strategic plan and any number of documents. But what I want you to do is to demonstrate to me what it's good for in terms of the Department of Energy mission.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay, let me be more precise. Because there's a mission statement for your part of the Department of Energy, and there's one for basic energy sciences, which is the part that is supporting my research, which is a different mission statement.
Mm-hmm.
And I can get five.
mm-hmm.
Are you talking about your mission statement? Are all five mission statements? Or the higher level DOE mission
mm-hmm.
statement? And he said, yes. So I said, let me restate what I'm
saying. Not helping you a whole lot.
No, he's helping me immensely.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I want to make sure we understand each other. You want me to help this laboratory demonstrate that it is making major contributions within any of the mission spaces that have been assigned to the Department of Energy. And he said, yes. I said, done.
Okay.
That's an easy assignment
because mm-hmm.
you don't have to be specifically pointed at this or that or the other. And we had a first-class set of scientists. It was the most advanced set of instrumentation existing anywhere for doing research in the molecular sciences and so on. And so it was a chance to operate at a different level, but sort of doing the kinds of things that I'd been doing for a while. And so unknown to me, I'd been training for that job.
You don't normally have access to these people at D.C. I mean, most people don't normally have access.
No.
But you were in a position or felt comfortable. I just went through the Council of Chemical Research and through other...
Sure.
Avenues. You knew you could talk to this guy. And,
yes.
And he said he'd
exactly.
entertain your concern.
Yes. He understood that perfectly. And it was kind of news to me, you know, that you could have that kind of thing. And so we were successful. So from officially from February.
Mm-hmm.
1999 to October 2002, I was a director in residence.
Mm-hmm.
But I actually was appointed in 98.
Mm-hmm.
And so after I said yes, I accepted. they started sending me to Washington again, again, again.
Mm-hmm.
And so I actually went pretty much every week for my final semester. At Delaware, I was making a trip to Washington to talk to somebody about something.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I was paid a consulting fee for this and followed all the university rules. And then I officially retired from the university at the end of that academic year.
Mm-hmm.
So the university was very good to us. There were all kinds of things that... I'd sort of picked up as a department chair, helping to bring in money to the university, hire right people, and so on. Going through two or three university presidents, and constancy of change is something
mm-hmm.
that I had gotten used to, that you don't normally think of as a university faculty member. You don't,
mm-hmm.
because within your surroundings, it's a very stable environment.
Mm-hmm.
But at my level, it was not stable. And it's certainly not stable at National Labs.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are changes every few years. So that's how I came to PNNL. And I had just extraordinary staff, extraordinary instrumentation. And so it's our job to sort of demonstrate value.
Mm-hmm.
And we succeed in doing that. So the basic energy sciences part of the Office of Science has national labs at the Lawrence Berkeley Lab, for example, at Argonne, at Oak Ridge,
mm-hmm.
Brookhaven, those examples, and long history. And so we were the run of the litter and the newcomer
mm-hmm.
To the enterprise. And so the way that they operate, I had learned a little bit about because my own research had been supported by DOE, mm-hmm. Basic Energy Sciences, and they had agreed to increase the size because the charge-out rate is significantly higher to pay the overheads
mm-hmm.
at a national lab. And so part of the agreement is I would move my DOE active research grant from Delaware to Richland
mm-hmm.
whenever the laboratories were ready here.
Mm-hmm.
I also encountered the safety standards and everything else at national laboratories that are distinctly different from university labs, and so I had to start over.
Mm-hmm.
So to execute, DOE had to recreate all of the instrumentation that was critical to my BES mm-hmm. grant when I came here. And so that involved two major instrument design and building experiments, which cost several millions of dollars, actually. Mm-hmm. By the time we were through with it. Because as I learned years ago, it was much more expensive to do something at a national laboratory than it is at other places.
Hmm.
Using union labor for everything, hmm. all of the craft practices, having all the checks and balances for what you do, and working in a really risk-averse environment.
Mm-hmm.
So anyhow, it all adds to the cost of doing business.
Mm-hmm.
But a combination of the Department of Energy and Battelle Corporate funded all the expenses of setting up my laboratory so I can move a research program from an academic setting here.
Mm-hmm.
And so we moved it out, and we gave my last set of students a choice. You can finish in location A or location B.
Mm-hmm.
I turned over my other federal grants to other persons to finish up and so forth. And we made the sort of abrupt step into life in different circles.
Mm-hmm.
One of the other differences I encounter is in a national laboratory, the time constant is much shorter.
Mm.
In other words, the time you have to demonstrate your good idea actually works is probably a factor of 3 to 5 shorter.
Mm.
Than it is at a university. Universities are sort of hooked to training students, graduate students.
Mm-hmm.
And so by definition, you're working with people who are not total professionals. And by definition, at National Labs, you are
mm-hmm.
working with people who are total professionals. And state-of-the-art machine shops and mm-hmm. support facilities and all of that. And so the funding is higher, but the time to demonstrate that your idea is good or bad is much shorter. And then the sort of funding strategies also depend on headquarters developing through workshops and so on and so on, how things are actually done. So those were things that were new and I had to learn and, mm-hmm. and so on. So anyhow, it's been a very interesting run. At the end of my term, I became a Battelle Fellow.
Mm-hmm.
And Battelle Fellow is an interesting title. It's a corporate title, so it's awarded by Battelle Corporate
mm-hmm.
based on recommendation of a lab director or maybe a set of lab directors and associate lab directors at one of the Battelle-operated national laboratories. So that would be the Office of Science Labs, actually Brookhaven, Oak Ridge, ourselves and Lawrence Livermore. No, Lawrence Livermore is a weapons lab. Sorry about that.
Mm-hmm.
So it'd be the Brookhaven, Oak Ridge, and PNNL, or the Battelle operated Office of Science National Labs. The Idaho lab is operated by Battelle for their nuclear reactor, part of Department of Energy.
Mm-hmm.
And then the weapons labs, Livermore involves a Battelle partnership in its operation. So Battelle is the largest single not-for-profit operator of Department of Energy labs. Also true, I believe, in the Department of Defense. And so there are, I believe, three major labs operated by Battelle for the Department of Defense in this country. And there are major labs in England and in Italy, smaller labs, Germany, Switzerland, France, Japan, Korea, China, so on.
Mm-hmm.
So Battelle is a worldwide R&D organization. Well, I believe there are six Battelle fellows. And so it was my honor to become one of those. And then I had the challenge to develop a statement of what a Battelle fellow is and does.
So I had to explain what you were.
Yeah, it had to be formalized. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So Richard Smith is the other Battelle fellow that you would know here. And I could name the others, but you probably wouldn't know them. There are four at PNNL. So we have more here than anywhere else. And that's where the job description was written. So for the personnel, now called HR, had to be a description of Battelle fellow and what he or she does. So I wrote it up, and my wife thought, there's no chance that'll be approved. And I said, you're right. That's just the negotiating position.
Mm-hmm.
It essentially says you will do more or less what you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
So you work out an annual contract with, in my case, PNNL, what it is you would like to do. And then at the end of that year, you'd be held accountable. And if you can demonstrate that you have added value, whatever, that you could go for a second year. And if you screw up, you have 1 year to get it sorted out and do better. But anyhow, that's essentially it. A Battelle fellow has the liberty to write his or her own job description in terms of some details. What are your goals for the year? What do you expect to achieve? And so on. And I developed goals. When I stopped being director of the Environmental Molecular Sciences Laboratory, having done it for 3 years, I guess a little over 3 years, we had doubled our funding. We had a staff of, I guess we're approaching 400, something like that, and I doubled the funding that existed when I came. And the biggest lift, the heaviest lift I had to do is to get the Department of Energy to understand that computers are supplies. They're not capital equipment.
Yes, that has changed.
Yes, and so we started out ordering, I think, the third largest computer that had ever been constructed. And it was pretty much off the list of the top 20 by the time that I came. I've heard rumors that it was sold on eBay for $100,000 or something like that. And so it represented a sort of a $20 million investment that should best be thought of as an office supply. Because within 5 years, it's going to be obsolete. And so it's sort of convincing people that they had to treat it that way.
It's
so,
a capital expense, but it's...
Sure, it's a capital expense. You have to reinvest on sort of a 5 or 6 year cycle. And so the procedure for going through that and how you do it and so on, the workshop that establishes the mission need, and then the the state of the art of computer development, projecting where it will be 3 years out,
mm-hmm.
and then
forget
what
that.
It takes to get there, and so on, and so on, and so on. So anyhow, as part of that, computer wing of the building had to increase by a factor of 5.
Wow.
And the energy bill to run it had to go up by 25,
yeah.
or something like that. And so, you know, that's a business expense. But it's a painful one.
Oh, yeah.
But that's, I guess, in a non-trivial sense, that was one of my major achievements as director.
Mm-hmm.
The other one is getting the lab on the map, and so we, you know, sent people to conferences, and we wrote papers, we developed covers. By the end of my term, we had a poster where we could show 20 or so covers,
mm-hmm.
Including a couple of mine, that then demonstrated in DOE headquarters, if they walked down the hallway,
mm-hmm.
ah, this is what this
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
user facility does,
mm-hmm.
and this is some of the evidence of scientific impact,
mm-hmm.
and so on. And so we had to gear up the user program and how that operates. And so anyhow, there have been many changes over time. The sort of mission approach of EMSL have changed. It's changed in directions that I'm not totally comfortable with, and would not have persuaded me to come here as director if those had been the
mm-hmm.
guidelines
mm-hmm.
at the time I was recruited. But I came here, bam, a new facility,
mm-hmm.
show us what it's good for.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did that. We did it very successfully. And so I actually ended up as Battelle Fellow in the largest office at PNNL.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had to remove myself from EMSL
mm-hmm.
and do something else. And, you know, finding a suitable office for a Battelle Fellow, I selected one that had been vacated, not knowing that it had once been Bill Wiley's office.
Uh-huh.
And so Bill Wiley, when he was developing the plans, occupied that office, and it was sort of 3 times the size of a typical executive office.
Mm.
So even after you subtract the conference room and some of the other adjoining spaces for showing slides, etc., it was still, by square feet, larger than the sitting lab director's office.
Mm.
And about 20% bigger than my office as director of EMSL.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I had plenty of space to put in Ann's artwork,
mm-hmm.
all of the things that I brought over, and then decided that I would work directly for the director and try to help define the scientific missions of PNNL.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started doing that, and so I went to visit other national laboratories, became reacquainted with what they were doing, and so on. And then, of course, I was replaced, and so they found a real staff person that would be in place for a number of years to work on that. And so I, you know, continued to do my own research, invested a little more energy in that probably for several years, and ended up in the course of a reorganization being involved in a new post, because in the reorganization, the funded scientists within EMSL, that is people that I had sort of encouraged and helped to do the science, that increased funding, that got the number of covers, I think it now stands at something like 600
mm-hmm.
posters
mm-hmm.
in a room. We have a room full of
mm-hmm.
posters now. These people were reassigned to the Fundamental and Computational Sciences
mm-hmm.
Research Directorate. And then the EMSL user facility became a much smaller laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so the people that I worked with most closely, including my own research group, Julia Laskin, are part of the
mm-hmm.
Fundamental and Computational Sciences Directorate. And when the Office of Chief Scientist for that directorate was created, I became the first one. And so that was helping to sort of define the future directions for people who were kind of closest to me and their research interest and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them that I had known from EMSL director times. So that was easy and fun and so on. Of course, they hired a real person to replace me in that.
Mm-hmm.
So although this is a nice job description, you lose it every 2 or 3 years when they hire somebody. And Julia Laskin took over my research funded the Department of Energy Research. So I am a courtesy member of her research group.
Mm-hmm.
But she runs it. She does a great job of doing that. And so I can't choose that anymore. But I did have an interesting job of writing strategic plan for the laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
By that I mean knowing the people that I could persuade to take time off of their real work
mm-hmm.
to write a credible strategic plan that had to be ready for the new administration when President Obama was elected.
Mm-hmm.
And tradition for new administrations, I think not since Glenn Seaborg was director of the Atomic Energy Commission, had someone who had a real total knowledge of Department of Energy science been named mm-hmm. as Secretary of Energy.
Mm-hmm.
And so typically for political or business or other reasons, someone gets selected eventually to fill out the cabinet.
Yeah.
But and so this strategic plan that you have to develop is a throwaway.
Mm-hmm.
Is never implemented, because by the time a new person is in charge and understands Department of Energy well enough to make any executive decisions, a new one has to be submitted.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the significant plan. And so I was in charge of helping out with the throwaway plan. Well, then Secretary Chu
mm-hmm.
was appointed.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the week after, week in November after Obama was elected,
mm-hmm.
the Secretary of Energy designate was announced.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was not Secretary of Energy, but he had an office in Washington, D.C. And the department, as a courtesy, extended him a certain number of staff
mm-hmm.
to help him do his work. And indeed, everybody else, in terms of the political appointees, came in with science credentials no one has seen in recent history
mm-hmm.
to do everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a completely unexpected thing.
You have science people running a science operation.
And so, you know, I take credit for it. It certainly wasn't me. But the people who put together that plan had one that looked so good that we got the largest chunk of funding from the Recovery Act of any of the Office of Science laboratories.
Mm.
And so I'll show you the new buildings on our campus
mm-hmm.
Tomorrow. And EMSL has two new wings on it and has bought $60 or $70 million worth of new toys and so on. And so it's kind of like it was when I came.
Mm-hmm.
It's now fully equipped with state-of-the-art instrumentation. And so that's kind of where things are at the moment.
So are you, you've kind of like retired, but you haven't retired.
That's right. So I have not retired. So I continue to be involved with, let's say, federal agencies and National Academy committees and so on, giving advice, writing reports, whether or not they're ever acted on or not.
Mm-hmm.
And one that that I co-authored with Alan Marshall let me see, I guess it was 6 years ago now, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
5 to 6 year time frame. Talked about next generation high resolution mass spectrometry.
Mm-hmm.
And so we funded, so parenthetically, in my other responsibilities as Battelle Fellow, I had funded the magnet lab at Florida State,
mm-hmm.
to give the best advice to me as part of one of the things on a high-performance magnet. They were self-funded internally to work on that because Alan had worked to get them to do this as well. So it was to be a totally self-contained, refrigerated magnet. So instead of putting nitrogen and helium in it, it would recover this and it would stay perpetually full,
mm-hmm.
if you kept the electricity turned on.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the concept, to develop a very high field superconducting magnet. How high field could you go, and could you do all of these things? Was the technology in place to take the next step? And we invited several people to participate in the workshop. Workshop report was written, reviewed, published, smiled upon.
Yeah.
But funding was not there. So Alan, sort of used that as a core for a research proposal to the NSF.
Mm.
And again, it was reviewed, but nothing projected to cost nearly $20 million was something that could be funded at the National Science Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly, we made noises within the Department of Energy, and sort of a postscript to this strategic plan was a recommendation that the Department of Energy, in collaboration with the Magnet Lab, develop such a FTICR spectrometer,
mm-hmm.
to operate at 21 Tesla.
Wow.
And so that was a proposal. And of course, when you submit a strategic plan in the DOE system, DOE has to approve it, or it goes nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so they looked at this and says, well, okay, $20 million, maybe around the room, $1 to $2 million a year. So it's not out of the question that you can develop this in 10. So we'll approve this to occur over a 12-year time period.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was part of the thing that went in and was approved. But the new decision makers at the Department of Energy said, you can't have a leading technology, whatever it is, if you're going to take 12 years to develop it.
No,
so submit a new plan to do it in 3 years or forget it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, all right, we can do that. In the meantime, in the Recovery Act testimony before Congress, the director of the National Science Foundation says, we have reviewed and recommended projects we cannot fund.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have shovel-ready projects. They're ready to go. One of those was Alan Marshall's project.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know of any other project in NSF history where it's approved by the director before the division,
mm-hmm.
acted on it.
Mm-hmm.
But the chemistry division accepted the challenge and approved it. And so Alan got Recovery Act funding.
Hmm.
We did not. So it looked as if we might.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, we said, yes, we can do it in 3 years. Give us money.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, hold on a minute. We don't simply award things on the basis of approved projects that involve major construction. So I said, what construction? We have a lab. We can dump out the instruments there.
Mm-hmm.
There's no construction. We have space to accommodate it. But what they mean is we review this as if it were a construction project. And so you have to have two levels of technical review and and validation and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And so it delayed our start by about 15 months compared to Alan Marshall before our project was approved. And it has to be funded out of the regular budget rather than Recovery Act funding.
Mm-hmm.
And so the difference is the money had to be spent within a short time frame.
Mm-hmm.
And the NSF defines money as spent when it's given to the university, when the university has control. And so their money was spent over a much shorter time frame than ours, because ours is reallocated every year. And so we have a much more cumbersome project. But anyhow, the upshot of all this is that we are collaborators with Alan Marshall in the creation of the world's first 21 Tesla FT-ICR spectrometers. Now, because they had money first and been working on it, we've learned an awful lot by being engaged with Alan and what he is doing. And so I say for the record, it's a total collaboration that we share information and ideas and best practices. And in their case, some results of their research as they built up a prototype spectrometer to test various concepts. But we're operating independently in terms of our ideas on how to do it. And beginning in January, we'll be testing these ideas in our prototype mass spectrometer. So in the meantime, as Battelle Fellow, my prime assignment to myself and to P&L is to understand the physics of the challenge of building this 21 Tesla FT-ICR spectrometer as best as one possibly can, and see to it that we adopt best practices and give us the best possible shot at actually making this happen. It's a formidable challenge.
Yeah. Okay?
I can point to various lines of evidence to support this, but let me just say this, that it's a tighter magnetic bottle than people have tackled before in terms of inserting ions into it. The fact that you want to use more of the homogeneous field, because you want to have higher dynamic range. That means you want to have more ions in there by at least a factor of 10 than commercial FT-ICRs. And so the challenge of containing larger number of ions and doing without them interfering unduly with each other. So I mentioned earlier the mirror effect, ion mirror effect. And that this is one of the limitations on mass resolution, because it exerts a drag anytime you come close. And we can define in terms of the physics what that means to any conductor while it's inside the intense magnetic field. So, well, we're outside the magnetic field, so we have to worry about these in terms of every conductor, every lens element that's involved, to a degree that's not bothered people in previous times. Also, if you have 100 charges, then very soon, if you have the same mass to charge ratio, then these Coulomb forces overpower the other forces, even in intense magnetic fields. And so this coupling of the individual particles together, in effect, forms a non-neutral plasma. And so the ions are rotating around their center line in the magnet field. And the magnetic field is no longer the ion cyclotron resonance formula. It's different from that by the rotational frequency of the plasma. So these things have been theorized and are known to exist, have been occasionally demonstrated a few times in my own lab, but never published. But anyhow, as you squeeze the ions tighter and tighter in the higher magnetic field. This happens sooner and sooner.
Mm.
And so it's a significant part of the challenge. And so we're going to be doing a sort of a strange form of plasma physics in ion cyclotron resonance at the higher magnetic fields.
Mm-hmm.
We also have to operate at much higher vacuum. Actually, vacuum, these plasmas are bulletproof for at least a paper I've written, but not published.
Mm-hmm.
Says they're bulletproof in terms of collisions. And so you don't need to worry about background gas collisions until you excite them to this high radius orbit in order to detect them.
Mm-hmm.
At that point in time, the hardcore collisions that I studied for years and Jack Beauchamp has taught us about, B-E-A-U-C-H-A-M-P, Jack Beauchamp from Caltech, has taught us about these hardcore collisions for larger peptides that actually involve collisions with multiple atoms and knock them out of the molecule. These things that change the identity of the ion, not by the RRKM kind of mechanisms or things we discussed previously. It's just a shattering, tear them out of the molecule that they're in, is going to be a limiting case to the transient that you can observe, and therefore to the resolving power that can be achieved. And so, you have to have additional stages of differential pumping. At least one, almost certainly two, and possibly three. So, interesting scientific
problem. Yeah, well, the problem is that it's physics.
Yeah, it is.
But
it
I mean,
is.
You're a chemical engineer.
That's right. but I took extra courses. And I know whom to call if I need help.
Yeah.
So anyhow, you put these additional stages, pumping stages.
Yeah.
You have to use ion funnels developed by my former student, Dick Smith. But I cite in my references for this interview the paper we wrote together doing the theory of ion funnels, the physics of what you're doing in ion funnels. So what you've done is you've moved your electrospray or whatever ion source further away from a magnet that's gotten bigger.
Right.
And the differential pumping requirements have gotten significantly higher. And so whether you like it or not, you have created a time-of-flight mass spectrometer. Okay? So what you also have to do is to do what used to be called velocity focusing. Okay? So you have to have the slow ones and the fast ones arrive in the important area at the same time.
Yeah.
So anyhow, everything new is also old. It's going back to the early days and we talked about the
time lag flight. Focusing.
Yes, time lag focusing in a different context comes back again. So because I was there, I understand time lag focusing. Because I was there, I have actually designed optics that will do that. And there are wonderful new technologies. The kinds of materials you can get are extraordinary. One other thing that's orders of magnitude more serious for this new spectrometer than was ever appreciated before is the absolute alignment. And so maintaining absolute integrity from whatever your starting point is for shooting the ions down the line so that they are online and not off axis, so that they interact with the magnetic field or any of the electric fields, including RF fields. So all existing commercial systems are off the table. None of them will work. So anyhow, in a strange sense, that's the kind of problem that I've really enjoyed thinking about over and over again. Where's Marvin? I need him.
Yeah, right. He's trying to build a super time of flight mass spectrometer. Oh,
yeah. I'm so glad he didn't present that invited talk until we got the money to do the other thing.
Might have changed the direction of things.
It'd be kind of fun if Marvin Vestal succeeded in building the highest resolution time of flight ever.
Yeah.
While I succeed, my team, building the lowest resolution ever.
As a front end to your FT.
As a front end to the FT. That'd be a wonderful irony if it worked out that way.
This was the irony of Al Neer. You know, he came up, he and Johnson came up with the Neer Johnson design, but what he actually had a space probe, or I think a high altitude probe, for which he abandoned that design and used the Mattel Herzog design.
Yes.
So right. he knew that that would work better than the one that he had done for himself. And it was kind of an interesting. He commented on that during the interview I did with him. It was kind of fun.
So anyhow, the other part of my research career, to sort of pick it up again, is already at Delaware. It was clear we had to move to larger molecules. It was already clear it had to be peptides. I attended a talk that Vicky Wysocki gave.
Mm-hmm.
That's V-I-C-K-I,
mm-hmm.
W-Y-S-O-C-K-I, in the Washington, D.C. discussion group, mass spectrometry discussion group.
Mm-hmm.
And at Delaware, we always took all of our graduate students down in a company car or some carpool or whatever. Any that we could get to attend that, we would always take them down for those technical sessions.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard her presentation of these curves for surface-induced association, where the parent ion is drops very quickly over a limited kinetic energy range, and then the products come up. And I saw that, and I said, that's not possible. That's what a much smaller ion might do, have sharp cutoffs, because of all the internal degrees of freedom that can't be correct.
Mm-hmm.
So, as I said, I'm always overjoyed when things that can't be correct turn out to be correct for some reason that you absolutely don't understand. So anyhow, I got intrigued by what she was talking about in surface-induced association.
Mm-hmm.
Her PhD mentor, Graham Cooks,
is
totally deserves credit for inventing, discovering surface-induced association. But it's not correct. I discovered it when, in the tandem mass spectrometer days, when I was learning how to steer ions and put them where I wanted.
They kept running into
something. There were a lot of things I ran into, and these diffuse peaks that I studiously ignored.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and some years later, actually, when Anil Shukla and I were building up a new tandem mass spectrometer, so with much higher resolution for the ions, because we knew we were going to have to do something like that, moving up in molecular weight, and you know, other bells and whistles. We rediscovered it because all of our mass peaks turned into doublets.
Mm-hmm.
And we had just enough resolution in the second stage analyzer to see that they were too broad and they had a dip in the middle. So every mass peak was a doublet.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that? Well, it had to be something in the ion flight path. It almost certainly had to be at the mass resolving slit, because that's the only place you could get a doublet up and down the mass range. And sure enough, there was a mustache hair. Now, we never determined whether it was his mustache or mine, but we had rediscovered over again surface-induced association. And we had Graham Cooks as part of our seminar series when I was at Delaware, and he was talking about some of the wonderful things that he was doing by SID, not with peptides, doing small molecules. I say, we have to describe what small is.
Mm-hmm.
These are the big molecules I was talking about earlier. So they're sort of benzene size and a little bit bigger, naphthalene, whatever. But not peptides. And he was showing the surface-induced dissociation in his talk. I'd introduced him. I was sitting in the front row. And I did a mean thing, sort of doing rough energetics for what he was doing. I calculated the center of mass for the collision process.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be the upper limit of energy that would be transferred
mm-hmm.
in a collision. I'd made a living doing this with molecular beam experiments for years. So, of course, it was very easy for me to do that. So, in the discussion period, after there had been a few interesting discussions, so I said, well, Graham, would you like to know what you're colliding with? And he says, well, I know what I'm colliding with. You know, I have this metal plate, this conductor, that I'm putting in there.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, no, you're not. First of all, this won't happen on a metal plate. If it's a real conductor
mm-hmm.
and absolutely clean,
mm-hmm.
I can explain to you later something I learned much earlier in my career, that it's going to be neutralized.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's not what's happening. And what you're doing is you're bouncing it off of pump oil. And so I can tell you the center of mass, and we can talk about volatility
mm-hmm.
of oils and so on. And we'll do this at dinner tonight. But you're looking at a contaminated surface, and that's causing your surface-induced dissociation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, we had an interesting discussion for dinner and so on. I'm sure he wasn't convinced. But I was convinced, and so I set it aside. I saw Vicky Wysocki's talk. And I said, this can't be true, so we have to take a look at it. And it was easy for me because she was at Virginia Commonwealth.
Yeah.
As John Finn was.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was easy for me to spend a day, just drive down and visit her.
Yeah.
Go into her lab, do the experiment, and by golly, it was true. Okay? All right, so this is very interesting. Also saw John Finn and had a nice conversation with him about what was going on in his laboratory and so on. And close to that point in time, Graham Cooks invited a plenary lecture, an international conference on mass spectrometry.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked about his surface-induced dissociation. And he talked about the surfaces that Vicky Wysocki was using. So this was self-assembled monolayers
mm-hmm.
on gold.
Mm-hmm.
And so the gold 111 surface, if you take an alkyl thiol, it will sit down and bond to that surface. And then you have this alkyl chain that's sticking up in space.
Mm-hmm.
And this has the marvelous character that it's physically precisely defined pump oil.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so what you have to create is neither an insulator nor a conductor, but a semiconductor.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So as far as the incoming ion beam is concerned, it has to be an insulator.
Mm-hmm.
And so it will bounce off. But the charges that are captured, and some will be, have to be neutralized.
Right.
And so they have to tunnel in, or whatever they do, to be neutralized by the conductor.
Mm-hmm.
And so Graham and his army of students had determined the chain link that was necessary to make it a semiconductor.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't know it was a semiconductor until I explained it to him.
Mm-hmm.
but you know, really precise characteristics. That, I guess, I owe my understanding to Peter Debye. When he wasn't talking to the janitor, took a little time to explain a few points to me.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out to be useful and interesting. So at that point in time, I said, okay, now we have a well-defined surface. So you can begin to do kind of experiments that I love to do to understand what's going on. And so that was our entree into surface-induced dissociation. Graham actually sent us the self-assembled monolayers, I recommended fluorine because I wanted to bounce ions off of pseudo Teflon. I actually can tell you the reduced mass, and I can tell you that odd even alternation effects have to do with the tetrahedral angle of carbon and whether the CF3 group is sticking up orthogonal to the surface or at a tetrahedral angle.
Wow.
Is that neat? Well, I know that because the beam scattering apparatus that Shukla and I built enabled us to do some of those experiments before a funding agency lost interest in understanding those kinds of details. So anyhow, we had learned some very valuable things. Vicki moved. She moved to University of Arizona.
Okay.
And she had some. She had a couple of students. There were two body problems. That is, a spouse wasn't ready to finish up, and so we co-chaired them, and they finished up at the University of Delaware.
Oh wow!
And I got to learn much more about peptides than I ever thought I'd be interested in learning. And having a long-term collaboration with Vicki Wysocki, it was interesting to me that my daughter ended up at the same university.
Yeah.
And so two or three times a year, I've always enjoyed visiting with Vicki Wysocki. And I'm chagrined to learn that she is now at Ohio State.
Oh, man. Another move.
So, gee, you know, I could have stayed, you know, in Ohio, been a professor at Ohio State, instead of bumping around the country and never holding a job very long.
Yeah.
So anyhow, the wonderful fact that Julia Laskin joined my research group, that she knew even, dare I say this, better than Marvin Vessel and others, the nuances of absolute rate theory, that it's identical to RRKM theory, and her thesis research and all of her research for a number of years with Hava Lifshitz dealt with that, including C60, and sort of applying it to a huge molecule like that. And so Julia was the perfect person to think about moving up to peptides and approaching it from a very sound theoretical basis. And we learned, to my amazement, that we can actually use this theory to describe the majority of collision-induced association for peptides up to a molecular weight of the order of 1,000. And so I was very surprised that this turned out to be the case. We also learned in the course of investigating that there were some things that could not. And we discovered some that are extremely fast. We call them shattering reactions.
Shattering.
And we demonstrate this experimentally at almost the same time that Bill Haase, William J. Haase, H-A-S-E, who holds the Welch Chair at Texas Tech, I believe.
Oh, okay.
School in West Texas.
Mm-hmm.
He's coming for dinner in a couple of weeks.
Mm.
I'll get to see him again. So when I received the Field and Franklin Award, both Julia and Bill Haase spoke at my seminar, showing the connection and overlap of the theory of these reactions that occur extremely rapidly, so fast that you don't have any chance for vibrational coupling with the rest of the molecule. And so we called them shattering reactions. We found those. The other thing that was demonstrated is something that Graham Cooks also introduced and gets credit for, and that's soft landing. Soft landing, okay. And so his idea, if he could decelerate ions as low as he could, that some of them actually land on the surface instead of doing collision-induced association.
Mm-hmm.
And he's absolutely correct. So it was a minor part of the surface-induced association project that we embarked on, and we had better deceleration lenses and so on. So we plotted curves where at the lowest energy, only thing you saw was the ion coming in. It was bouncing off of the surface, so nothing was happening. And then you open the lowest energy channel, highest energy channel, and so on, and march up the RRKM range of things until you get to very high energies when these very fast reactions mm-hmm. begin to dominate what's going on. And I had found these kinds of reactions in my beam studies of very small molecules and ions earlier on. And in fact, Henry Eyring and I had discussed this.
Mm.
How big is big? Mm. So if you apply your theory, sir, absolute rate theory, at what point is a molecule so big that one end doesn't know what's going on at the other end?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, how rapid is the transfer?
Mm-hmm.
It's called intramolecular vibrational mm-hmm. relaxation. How fast is that compared to finding a low energy dissociation channel and falling apart? So anyhow, our first attention was focused on surface-induced association. We showed a number of unique properties and one or more invited talks. I called it a chemist cyclotron because you could deposit arbitrary amounts of energy. We had discovered in these specific semiconductor surfaces, there's a fairly narrow energy range, and you can actually go down to low energy, and you can go up to high energy, and this window walks up.
Hmm.
So in a single collision, you can distribute any desired amount of energy with some range of window, a range mm-hmm. of energies. And that range of energies depends on how you make your semiconductor surface.
Mm-hmm.
You can make a soft surface and make it wide. You can make a narrow surface, and it's narrow. A vapor deposited diamond is a very narrow, very hard, very robust mm-hmm. surface.
I bet.
For doing that kind of a project. And then we later turned our attention, we found these very fast reactions. They also made sense to us. It made sense to Henry Eyring.
This was at Utah?
Well, at Utah we discussed it.
Yeah.
And then years later in my career, after Henry Eyring's death, I did molecular beam experiments to find these very, very rapid reactions.
It's
a Utah primarily, and probably extended over a bit into Delaware.
Mm-hmm.
But it was sort of small molecule, how fast do things occur,
mm-hmm.
and compare dissociation and electronic excitation, those kinds of things. Very short time events and longer time events. So anyhow, we had found that kind of phenomena. And so that it was lurking there was not so surprising. The fact that you could find it and it would be a fairly sharp threshold and so on were surprises to us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something years ago I thought I might, in my retirement years, look into that.
Mm-hmm.
I still fantasize I might think about that.
Mm-hmm.
A little later on, and I'll talk to Bill Hazy about it
mm-hmm.
when he comes in a couple of weeks. But that's fantasy. Mm-hmm. What I told you, the things I was doing otherwise. But what I do want to say is that the soft landing area has become, I won't say the center point, but a major emphasis for the Laskin group going forward.
Mm-hmm.
And so really soft landing, you can prepare these surfaces so the ion actually lands on an ion, as an ion.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very easy to lift off.
Mm-hmm.
And if you vent it, it's gone.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. But as long as you keep it under vacuum with the proper kind of surface, you can actually keep it there. for quite a long time as an ion. And if you deposit doubly charged or triply charged, quadruply charged ions, you can look at the rate of the electron transfer process. And you can work out the kinetics of the details of how triply charged ions change to a doubly, to singly, to a neutral. And so this whole process that I guess I thought about and talked about with physicists at the very beginning, you can spread out in time by doing it on very special surfaces. And so a take-home lesson that I find amazing that we actually talked about at the University of Delaware in workshops I was part of with theoretical chemists and so on, is that surface science has so many analogies to what you do in the gas phase and the condensed phase, okay, by definition. And so by studying surfaces in particular ways, you can actually uncover details that tell you a lot about what's going on in bulk and is consistent with what you have established to happen in the gas phase. Amazing thing that you can actually do experiments and learn such a wealth of details. So let's see, I guess you could say in a weird sense, Graham Cooks has always claimed mass spectrometers are the ultimate chemistry laboratory and are capable of doing anything and everything. And I believed him, and I consider him a mass spectrometer as the ultimate chemical physics laboratory that you can do anything. And part of my work for over many years, many publications in molecular beam scattering studies, was to demonstrate that every nuance that the molecular beam community had discovered for neutrals is also present for ions. Okay, the fact that they're charged, I mean, you can migrate them around and study them in much smaller abundance than you can the neutrals. But every single aspect that has been found for neutrals has its counterpart in ion chemistry and physics. So it's been a wonderful period to do all of that. What's Graham doing now? Well, he's doing atmospheric pressure ionization. Okay? He's dissecting the electrospray process to all of its parts. And he's giving invited plenary lectures announcing these amazing discoveries. They are truly amazing. And then when he sits down, I tell him, no, that's not what you're doing. This is what's going on. And so I told him that he was scattering droplets, scattering invisible droplets. His first story was wrong. And so, of course, he's modeled the scattering of droplets, and that is what he's doing. And so there are actually commercial sources that allow you to find the preferred angle for scattering of invisible droplets from surfaces. Well, Emsel bought one of those, and we actually did some experiments with it, and so on. That's correct. But you can dissect the whole thing further, and Julia and her coworkers are doing that, because if you're just scattering droplets and then you just have a hose to pick them up somewhere, that's not nearly as elegant as it is to define very precisely the region where the droplets are hitting and the region where you're picking them up. And so she and her students have increased the sensitivity of that kind of process. And that's actually reported this week as one of the outstanding science achievements of PNNL. So anyhow, I've been the luckiest of individuals to sort of, by accident, arrive at the right place at the right time and do something that was very interesting to me and seemed to have quite a few spinoffs and other dimensions. So it's been fun.
Yeah, well, it sounds like it's been fun. It's been fun listening about it as far as we've gotten. I got some other issues I'd like to go over. But
you mean we're not through?
Well, we're getting close, but I think maybe we ought to hang it up for today, for sure, or maybe at least for now. And maybe
I think so, too.
Think about coming back. We can look at that collection of things and see how well we've covered all that territory. In the meantime, I'll put this guy to sleep.